It is still a strange story, though an old one, how they came out of Orient lands, crowned with the majesty of kings and clothed with something of the mystery of magicians. The truth, that is, tradition, has wisely remembered them almost as unknown quantities, as mysterious as their mysterious and melodious names, Melchior, Caspar, Balthazar. But there came with them all that world of wisdom that had watched the stars in Chaldea and the sun in Persia. And we shall not be wrong if we see in them the same curiosity that moves all the sages. They would stand for the same human ideal if their names had really been Confucius or Pythagoras or Plato. They were those who sought not tales, but the truth of things. And since their thirst for truth was itself a thirst for God, they also have had their reward. But even in order to understand that reward, we must understand that for philosophy as much as mythology, that reward was the completion of the incomplete. Such learned men would doubtless have come, as these learned men did come, to find themselves confirmed in much that was true in their own traditions and right in their own reasoning. Confucius would have found a new foundation for the family in the very reversal of the Holy Family. Buddha would have looked upon a new renunciation of stars rather than jewels and divinity rather than royalty. These learned men would still have the right to say, or rather, a new right to say, that there was truth in their old teaching. But after all, these learned men would have come to learn. They would have come to complete their conceptions with something they had not yet conceived, even to balance their imperfect universe with something they might once have contradicted. Buddha would have come from his impersonal paradise to worship a person. Confucius would have come from his temples of ancestor worship to worship a child. We must grasp from the first this character in the new cosmos, that it was larger than the old cosmos. In that sense, Christendom is larger than creation, as creation had been before Christ. It included things that had not been there. It also included the things that had been there. The point happens to be well illustrated in this example of Chinese piety, but it would be true of other pagan virtues or pagan beliefs. Nobody can doubt that a reasonable respect for parents is part of a gospel in which God himself was subject in childhood to earthly parents. But the other sense, in which the parents were subject to him, does introduce an idea that is not Confucian. The infant Christ is not like the infant Confucius. Our mysticism conceives him in an immortal infancy. I do not know what Confucius would have done with the bambino, had it come to life in his arms as it did in the arms of St. Francis. But this is true in relation to all the other religions and philosophies. It is the challenge of the Church. The Church contains what the world does not contain. Life itself does not provide as she does for all sides of life. That every other system is narrow and insufficient compared to this one, that is not a rhetorical boast. It is a real fact. And a real dilemma. Where is the holy child amid the Stoics and the ancestor worshippers? Where is Our Lady of the Moslems, a woman made for no man and set above all angels? Where is Saint Michael of the monks of Buddha, rider and master of the trumpets, guarding for every soldier the honor of the sword? What could Saint Thomas Aquinas do with the mythology of Brahmanism? He who set forth all the science and rationality, and even rationalism of Christianity. Yet, even if we compare Aquinas with Aristotle, at the other extreme of reason, we shall find the same sense of something added. Aquinas could understand the most logical parts of Aristotle. It is doubtful if Aristotle could have understood the most mystical parts of Aquinas. Even where we can hardly call the Christian greater, we are forced to call him larger. But it is so to whatever philosophy or heresy or modern movement we may turn. How would Francis the Troubadour have fared among the Calvinists, or for that matter, among the utilitarians of the Manchester school? Yet men like Bossuet and Pascal could be as stern and logical as any Calvinist or utilitarian. How would St. Joan of Arc, a woman waving on men to war with the sword, have fared among the Quakers or the Duchabors or the Tolstoyan sect of pacifists? Yet any number of Catholic saints have spent their lives in preaching peace and preventing wars. It is the same with all the modern attempts at syncretism. They are never able to make something larger than the creed without leaving something out. I do not mean leaving out something divine, but something human. The flag, or the N, or the boy's tale of battle, or the hedge at the end of the field. The theosophists build a pantheon, but it is only a pantheon for pantheists. They call a parliament of religion as a reunion of all the peoples, but it is only a reunion of all the prigs. Yet exactly such a pantheon had been set up 2,000 years before by the shores of the Mediterranean, and Christians were invited to set up the image of Jesus side by side with the image of Jupiter, of Mithras, of Osiris, of Attis, or of Ammon. It was the refusal of the Christians that was the turning point of history. If the Christians had accepted, they and the whole world would have certainly, in a grotesque but exact metaphor, gone to pot. They would all have been boiled down to one lukewarm liquid in that great pot of cosmopolitan corruption, in which all the other myths and mysteries were already melting. It was an awful and an appalling escape. Nobody understands the nature of the church, or the ringing note of the creed descending from antiquity, who does not realize that the whole world once very nearly died of broad-mindedness and the brotherhood of all religions. Here it is the important point that the Magi, who stand for mysticism and philosophy, are truly conceived as seeking something new and even as finding something unexpected. That tense sense of crisis which still tingles in the Christmas story and even in every Christmas celebration accentuates the idea of a search and a discovery. The discovery is, in this case, truly a scientific discovery. For the other mystical figures in the miracle play, for the angel and the mother, the shepherds and the soldiers of Herod, there may be aspects both simpler and more supernatural, more elemental or more emotional. But the wise men must be seeking wisdom, and for them there must be a light also in the intellect. And this is the light, that the Catholic creed is Catholic, and that nothing else is Catholic. The philosophy of the Church is universal. The philosophy of the philosophers was not universal. Had Plato and Pythagoras and Aristotle stood for an instant in the light that came out of that little cave, they would have known that their own light was not universal. It is far from certain, indeed, that they did not know it already. Philosophy also, like mythology, had very much the air of a search. It is the realization of this truth that gives its traditional majesty and mystery to the figures of the three kings. the discovery that religion is broader than philosophy, and that this is the broadest of religions, contained within this narrow space. The magicians were gazing at the strange pentacle with the human triangle reversed, and they have never come to the end of their calculations about it. For it is the paradox of that group in the cave that while our emotions about it are of childish simplicity, our thoughts about it can branch with a never-ending complexity. And we can never reach the end even of our own ideas about the child who was a father and the mother who was a child. We might well be content to say that mythology had come with the shepherds and philosophy with the philosophers, and that it only remained for them to combine in the recognition of religion. But there was a third element that must not be ignored, and one which that religion forever refuses to ignore in any revel or reconciliation. There was present in the primary scenes of the drama that enemy that had rotted the legends with lust and frozen theories into atheism, but which answered the direct challenge with something of that more direct method which we have seen in the conscious cult of the demons. In the description of that demon worship, of the devouring detestation of innocence shown in the works of its witchcraft and the most inhuman of its human sacrifice, I have said less of its incorrect and secret penetration of the saner paganism, the soaking of mythological imagination with sex, the rise of imperial pride into insanity. But both the indirect and the direct influence make themselves felt in the drama of Bethlehem. A ruler under the Roman suzerainty, probably equipped and surrounded with the Roman ornament and order though himself of Eastern blood, seems in that hour to have felt stirring within him the spirit of strange things. We all know the story of how Herod, alarmed at some rumor of a mysterious rival, remembered the wild gesture of the capricious despots of Asia, and ordered a massacre of suspects of the new generation of the populace. Everyone knows the story, but not everyone has perhaps noted its place in the story of the strange religions of men. Not everybody has seen the significance even of its very contrast with the Corinthian columns and Roman pavement of that conquered and superficially civilized world. Only, as the purpose in his dark spirit began to show and shine in the eyes of the Idumean, a seer might perhaps have seen something like a great gray ghost that looked over his shoulder, have seen behind him, filling the dome of night and hovering for the last time over history, that vast and fearful face that was Moloch of the Carthaginians, awaiting his last tribute from a ruler of the races of Shem. The demons also, in that first festival of Christmas, feasted after their own fashion. Unless we understand the presence of that enemy, we shall not only miss the point of Christianity, but even miss the point of Christmas. Christmas for us in Christendom has become one thing, and in one sense, even a simple thing. But like all the truths of that tradition, it is, in another sense, a very complex thing. Its unique note is the simultaneous striking of many notes. Of humility, of gaiety, of gratitude, of mystical fear, but also of vigilance and of drama. It is not only an occasion for the peacemakers any more than for the merrymakers. It is not only a Hindu peace conference any more than it is only a Scandinavian winter feast. There is something defiant in it also, something that makes the abrupt bells at midnight sound like the great guns of a battle that has just been won. All this indescribable thing that we call the Christmas atmosphere only hangs in the air as something like a lingering fragrance or fading vapor from the exultant explosion of that one hour in the Judean hills nearly 2,000 years ago. But the savor is still unmistakable, and it is something too subtle or too solitary to be covered by our use of the word peace. By the very nature of the story, the rejoicings in the cavern were rejoicings in a fortress or an outlaw's den. Properly understood, it is not unduly flippant to say they were rejoicings in a dugout. It is not only true that such a subterranean chamber was a hiding place from enemies, and that the enemies were already scouring the stony plain that lay above it like a sky. It is not only that the very horse hoofs of Herod might, in that sense, have passed like thunder over the sunken head of Christ. It is also that there is in that image a true idea of an outpost, of a piercing through the rock, and an entrance into an enemy territory. There is, in this buried divinity, an idea of undermining the world, of shaking the towers and palaces from below. Even as Herod the great king felt that earthquake under him and swayed with his swaying palace. That is perhaps the mightiest of the mysteries of the cave. It is already apparent that though men are said to have looked for hell under the earth, in this case it is rather heaven that is under the earth. And there follows, in this strange story, the idea of an upheaval of heaven. That is the paradox of the whole position, that henceforth the highest thing can only work from below. Royalty can only return to its own by a sort of rebellion. Indeed, the church, from its beginnings, and perhaps especially in its beginnings, was not so much a principality as a revolution against the prince of the world. This sense that the world had been conquered by the great usurper and was in his possession has been much deplored or derided by those optimists who identify enlightenment with ease. But it was responsible for all that thrill of defiance and a beautiful danger that made the good news seem to be really both good and new. It was, in truth, against a huge unconscious usurpation that it raised a revolt, and originally so obscure a revolt. Olympus still occupied the sky, like a motionless cloud molded into many mighty forms. Philosophy still sat in the high places, and even on the thrones of the kings, when Christ was born in the cave, and Christianity in the catacombs. In both senses we may remark the same paradox of revolution, the sense of something despised and of something feared. The cave, in one aspect, is only a hole or corner into which the outcasts are swept like rubbish. Yet, in the other aspect, it is a hiding place of something valuable, which the tyrants are seeking like treasure. In one sense, they are there because the innkeeper would not even remember them, and in another, because the king can never forget them. We have already noted that this paradox appeared also in the treatment of the early church. It was important while it was still insignificant, and certainly while it was still impotent. It was important solely because it was intolerable. And in that sense, it is true to say that it was intolerable because it was intolerant. It was resented, because in its own still and almost secret way, it had declared war. It had risen out of the ground to wreck the heaven and earth of heathenism. It did not try to destroy all that creation of gold and marble, but it contemplated a world without it. It dared to look right through it, as though the gold and marble had been glass. Those who charged the Christians with burning down Rome with firebrands were slanderers, but they were, at least, far nearer to the nature of Christianity than those among the moderns who tell us that the Christians were a sort of ethical society, being martyred in a languid fashion for telling men they had a duty to their neighbors, and only mildly disliked because they were meek and mild. Herod had his place, therefore, in the miracle play of Bethlehem, because he is the menace to the church militant, and shows it from the first as under persecution and fighting for its life. For those who think this a discord, it is a discord that sounds simultaneously with the Christmas bells. For those who think the idea of the crusade is one that spoils the idea of the cross, we can only say that for them the idea of the cross is spoiled. The idea of the cross is spoiled quite literally in the cradle. It is not here to the purpose to argue with them on the abstract ethics of fighting. The purpose in this place is merely to sum up the combination of ideas that make up the Christian and Catholic idea, and to note that all of them are already crystallized in the first Christmas story. They are three distinct and commonly contrasted things which are nevertheless one thing. But this is the only thing which can make them one. The first is the human instinct for a heaven that shall be as literal and almost as local as a home. It is the idea pursued by all poets and pagans making myths, that a particular place must be the shrine of the god, or the abode of the blessed, that fairyland is a land, or that the return of the ghost must be the resurrection of the body. I do not hear reason about the refusal of rationalism to satisfy this need. I only say that if the rationalists refuse to satisfy it, the pagans will not be satisfied. This is present in the story of Bethlehem and Jerusalem, as it is present in the story of Delos and Delphi, and as it is not present in the whole universe of Lucretius, or the whole universe of Herbert Spencer. The second element is a philosophy larger than other philosophies, larger than that of Lucretius and infinitely larger than that of Herbert Spencer. It looks at the world through 100 windows, where the ancient Stoic or the modern agnostic only looks through one. It sees life with thousands of eyes belonging to thousands of different sorts of people, where the other is only the individual standpoint of a Stoic or an agnostic. It has something for all moods of man. It finds work for all kinds of men. It understands secrets of psychology. It is aware of depths of evil. It is able to distinguish between ideal and unreal marvels and miraculous exceptions. It trains itself intact about hard cases, all with a multiplicity and subtlety and imagination about the varieties of life which is far beyond the bald or breezy platitudes of most ancient or modern moral philosophy. In a word, there is more in it. It finds more in existence to think about. It gets more out of life. Masses of this material about our many-sided life have been added since the time of St. Thomas Aquinas. But St. Thomas Aquinas alone would have found himself limited in the world of Confucius or of Comte. And the third point is this: that while it is local enough for poetry and larger than any other philosophy, it is also a challenge and a fight. while it is deliberately broadened to embrace every aspect of truth, it is still stiffly embattled against every mode of error. It gets every kind of man to fight for it. It gets every kind of weapon to fight with. It widens its knowledge of the things that are fought for and against with every art of curiosity or sympathy. But it never forgets that it is fighting. It proclaims peace on earth and never forgets why there was war in heaven. That is the Trinity of Truth symbolized here by the three types in the old Christmas story, the shepherds and the kings and that other king who warred upon the children. It is simply not true to say that other religions and philosophies are, in this respect, its rivals. It is not true to say that any one of them combines these characters. It is not true to say that any one of them pretends to combine them. Buddhism may profess to be equally mystical. It does not even profess to be equally military. Islam may profess to be equally military. It does not even profess to be equally metaphysical and subtle. Confucianism may profess to satisfy the needs of the philosophers for order and reason. It does not even profess to satisfy the need of the mystics for miracle and sacrament and the consecration of concrete things. There are many evidences of this presence of a spirit at once universal and unique. One will serve here, which is the symbol of the subject of this chapter. That no other story, no pagan legend or philosophical anecdote or historical event, does in fact affect any of us with that peculiar and even poignant impression produced on us by the word Bethlehem. No other birth of a god or childhood of a sage seems to us to be Christmas or anything like Christmas. It is either too cold or too frivolous or too formal and classical or too simple and savage or too occult and complicated. Not one of us, whatever his opinions, would ever go to such a scene with the sense that he was going home. He might admire it because it was poetical, or because it was philosophical, or any number of other things in separation, but not because it was itself. The truth is that there is a quite peculiar and individual character about the hold of this story on human nature. It is not in its psychological substance at all like a mere legend or the life of a great man. It does not exactly, in the ordinary sense, turn our minds to greatness, to those extensions and exaggerations of humanity which are turned into gods and heroes even by the healthiest sort of hero worship. It does not exactly work outwardly, adventurously, to the wonders to be found at the ends of the earth. It is rather something that surprises us from behind, from the hidden and personal part of our being, like that which can sometimes take us off our guard in the pathos of small objects or the blind pieties of the poor. It is rather as if a man had found an inner room in the very heart of his own house, which he had never suspected, and seen a light from within. It is as if he found something at the back of his own heart that betrayed him into good. It is not made of what the world would call strong materials, or rather, it is made of materials whose strength is in that winged levity with which they brush us and pass. It is all that is in us, but a brief tendency that is there, made eternal. All that means no more than a momentary softening that is in some strange fashion become a strengthening and a repose. It is the broken speech and the lost word that are made positive and suspended unbroken. As the strange kings fade into a far country and the mountains resound no more with the feet of the shepherds, and only the night and the cavern lie in fold upon fold over something more human than humanity. End of chapter 1, book 2.